And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Over the years, I've had a lot of long and interesting conversations with Adam Negurny, the great New York Times correspondent, now the LA bureau chief, but for years, their chief political writer. I sat down with Adam on a recent visit to Los Angeles to assess his career, the state of journalism, and our politics. Adam Negurny, good to see you.
Thanks,
out here
David.
In your new natural habitat, Los Angeles. I'm not used to that. You're a New York City guy. You're from New York.
Yeah, I'm from the suburbs of New York, yeah, Westchester. I was born in New York City, but I grew up in Westchester.
And there isn't a lot written about you, I think by design, because you want everything else to be the story. That's the old reporter's instinct.
I was about to say, why do you think that? But I guess it's the same.
Exactly. There it is. You see, it's coming out already. But I know that both you and one of your siblings, your brother, became journalists. And
right.
I was wondering if that had anything to do with your folks, or was it a coincidence that you both...
No, I don't think it was a coincidence. I mean, my father, first of all, my parents were both avid New York Times readers. You know, we grew up in Times, you know, Westchester, so we grew up in a house where there was always a New York Times. My father was the head of Quadrangle Books for a while. Quadrangle Books was the New York Times.
I see.
So it was always part of the culture. And if you grew up in New York, like, you know, here in L.A., like, you see Leonardo DiCaprio at a table and everyone's like, oh, my God. You know, back in New York, if you saw Abe Rosenthal at a table, it'd be like a bigger celebrity sighting. So it was a big part of my life. So I think that's what we both ended up going in journalism. Eric and I both went to the same college, SUNY Purchase. We both worked for the school newspaper. We both worked – he worked for Newsday, I think, at one point. But we both worked for the Gannett Westchester newspapers, and now we both work for the Times.
You and you knew – from the beginning that this is what you wanted to do.
Yeah. So when I was a freshman in college, somebody just came to me and said, do you want to write a story for the school paper? And I literally, it was called The Load, L-O-A-D. I didn't name it. it was a weekly. And I don't think this is apocryphal. You could ask people who knew me then. Literally, like, I knew from that moment, not only did I want to be a reporter, but did I want to work for the New York Times, and I wanted to be the national political reporter for the New York Times. And in fact,
there's
some written proof of this, in that I wrote a letter to Adam Clymer, who you might know.
Yes, sure, I remember Adam.
He was a political reporter of the New York Times in 1978 or whatever, when I was in college. I said, Mr. Clymer, you know, you don't know me. I want your job. You have nothing to worry about, but I'd love to come in there and talk to you and find out how I could get your job.
And did he invite you in?
So what happened is, he invites me in, you know, I'm like really nervous. I got a haircut, you know, I put on a tie and stuff. You know, I showed up at the Times, I walked upstairs, and he took me upstairs to the cafe. You know, an important detail, he didn't call back or write back at first, which is fine. So I finally called, figuring like he'd have a phalanx of secretaries around him, and he picked up his phone himself. He said, oh yeah, of course, get your letter, come on up. And I went up and he had a cup of coffee with me for the New York Times, at the New York Times cafeteria. And, yeah.
That's such an important thing. You know, when I was in college, I wrote for a paper called the Hyde Park Herald around the University of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I was doing an investigative piece about a race that I was involved in and some of the fundraising that was going on around it. And I called a guy named Chuck Neubauer, who was an investigative reporter at the Tribune and won several Pulitzer Prizes and so on. And Chuck gave me sort of advice on how to do this piece. And we later became colleagues on the Tribune and ended up doing some reporting together. But I never forgot the kindness that he extended me. And, you know, I think that there is almost an obligation on the part of journalists to do that. But so you had this experience.
Right.
Clymer gave you, you looked around, you checked out what your future desk would be and asked him how long he'll be. And
I was too nervous. I really was looking around for, like, I don't know whether Scotty Reston was around at that point, but I was looking around for all these sort of big names. So,
yeah.
I mean, it was a big deal to me. It really was.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but then, no one starts, as the national political writer for the New York Times. So you worked for this Gannett paper
right.
in Westchester.
Right.
And what were you covering?
So for the Reporter Dispatch, what happened, I was working at my school paper, The Load. I think I told you
The Load, yes.
And there was a guy there who knew – he worked for the Reporter Dispatch. His name was Byron Rimas.
This was the Gannett paper in Westchester.
Yeah. And he sort of introduced me to the editor and got me a job there as a stringer. And I got paid by the story. And once I got out of college, I was just doing it all the time. And I was
– When you got the load off your mind.
I got the load off my mind. Yes. And I was getting paid – sorry – I was getting paid $25 a shot per story, and at a certain point, I was writing so many stories, they made a decision like they should, you know, I was making more than the staff people, so they brought me in on staff.
So what kind of stories were you
so
writing?
So zoning boards, and you know, I bet you did this too. You come in the morning and, you know, call the police departments to find out what's going on, obituaries, you know, I would write, man, this won't shock you, but I'd write 75 inches on zoning board disputes and white plates. I really did. Like in retrospect, I'm not sure what I was thinking. What were readers thinking? What were editors thinking? But I loved it. You know, I loved it.
They probably were happy they found a guy who was stimulated by that.
That's right. It could fill space. And then crime. You know, you have when you cover beats like that, you have your occasional like great crime stories. And you know, I remember riding around on a snowplow in Putnam County where I worked for a while, talking about what it was like clearing snow. And
so, you know, I wrote about politics when I was working for this paper, the Hyde Park Herald. I had a column. And when I got to the Tribune as an intern, the Chicago Tribune, the editor said, look, you know everything about Chicago politics, but you don't know about being a reporter. And so we're going to put you on nights, you know. And I spent 2.5 years on nights. It was the greatest education I ever had because I was exposed to, you know, it was all very much sort of murder, mayhem, fires, trains falling off of the L tracks, planes crashing and so on. But lots of human drama, lots of deadline writing, lots of taking rewrite from the night police reporter who would describe these heinous scenes and always finish by saying foul play is suspected, which is the sense of humor those guys always. But
the other thing you learn, I bet you did too, is like, and it was a really important lesson. Like, you're writing about people, right? So, I mean, it sounds schmaltzy, corny, but it's not. So it really made an impetus to get things right. Because when you're working on a small paper like that and you make a mistake, say an obituary or a pop check or something, you hear about it from real people. And I just thought that was a great way to learn that.
Yeah, I was not involved with this, thank God, but there was a legendary alderman in Chicago named Vito Marzullo. And he, Vito, was quite ill. And someone got a tip that he had died, and someone prematurely put in the paper that – and he called outraged about this just to personally assert that he was not dead. He did die sometime shortly after that. But when you're not when you're dealing with public officials, but oftentimes you're writing stories about some tragic event in people's lives, and you don't want to get those things, you don't want to get those things wrong. But you knew, even as you were doing that, as I knew, that you wanted to cover politics. Why did you want to cover politics?
Wow, I can't explain that. I just knew there's something about it. I mean, you know, from when I was a kid, I was reading political stories. I just loved it. I mean, I just loved it from the early days of politics in New York. And then my favorite stories in Westchester were like city council races. I don't know what it was. It was just something that really, really appealed to me. And I never lost interest in it. I just always found it more and more interesting.
And you were still in Westchester when you covered the election of someone who became sort of a gigantic figure in American politics, Mario Cuomo. Were you still there for that?
Excuse me. I was still there. I covered his election.
1982 it would be.
Yeah, I also feel – could I have covered his mayoral – I guess not.
77.
Maybe
he ran for mayor.
I remember, but I definitely did his governor's race. And I remember like – and this will – I mean, now it might not sound like much, but I remember being up in this suite with him when he got the result because I always tried to get into the suite of the candidate, right? And you just really felt you were right inside. And then covering him when he first became governor and dealing with his son Andrew, who's now the governor, as you well know. And after I worked, you know, I was working for Gannett Westchester Newspapers when I covered that race. And I think after that, they sent me up to Albany. And then I got hired by Marshall Kramer at the Daily News to cover the Mario Cuomo.
So tell me about Mario Cuomo. What were your impressions? You obviously covered the sweep of his political career from that moment to his sort of career-making speech at the Democratic Convention in San Francisco, and then the flirtations with the presidential races for succeeding cycles. Talk about him, because to me he was a kind of larger than life figure in American politics.
He was. So he was, like, I think I've covered three, and I think you know all of them, but three candidates for president, or almost candidates for president, who really, like, I am so lucky to be covering this person. Mario Cuomo was one, with all his flaws, which I'll talk about in a second. Bill Clinton was another, and the other was, of course, Barack Obama. So with Clinton, you know, Cuomo was just a really brilliant guy. He was a brilliant speaker, intellectual, tortured character. You know, he never
tortured
was,
in what way?
Like, he never, he never really felt like, you always got the feeling with him that he was never really sure he was good enough for what he was doing, and, you know, he'd have these long conversations with you. But the two things, one is he was just a great speaker, and he had an ability to walk into a room and frame an argument and grab an audience, and, you know, Bill Clinton had that ability. Barack Obama didn't even have that, as well as Mario Cuomo did, and he was just a smart, substantial guy who I think really cared about stuff. But the negative I was going to say is he also taught me, like, no one taught me more than him how to be tough, because he would, like, he was notorious for, if he didn't like coverage, calling up.
He'd call you, right?
Yeah, so I remember calling him one morning. I don't know if this story is inappropriate or not. I had just been.
No, it's a podcast. Man.
Okay.
No inappropriate
okay.
stories.
Okay, so I just been. So Marsha Kramer had been the bureau chief of the Daily News. They had sent her down to be the bureau chief down in New York City.
Yeah.
The editor at the time, Arthur Brown, said to me, you know, we really don't know whether you're ready to be bureau chief. You got to prove yourself. So, right, that's the way you get a reporter.
Right.
So I wrote some story about something, who knows what, right? And something American was very sensitive about, like, he might have commuted a sentence or something like that. And the phone rings at 7 in the morning, and I pick it up. I'm sure I've been up till 2 in the morning the night before. And it's like, I pick up the phone, I say, hello, and all I hear on the other phone is, you cut off my testicle. I'm like, what? And he starts yelling at me about how unfair this story was, and how I went out to destroy him, and I tried to help you, but I'm not going to help you now. And bam, hangs up the phone. So I call up two people. I call one person. Andrew Cuomo was his father's
Gatekeeper. I mean, he was political alter ego.
Dollar a year, right?
And enforcer.
Enforcer is a better word. So I come up and I tell him this story because I'm scared, right? And he goes, what? He said, cut off your testicle, not testicles? That's really bad. Oh my God. But then that night I had dinner with, I don't know if you ever knew him, the New York Times bureau chief at the time. His name was Jeff Schmaltz.
And he's I know the name. I didn't know him.
Fantastic reporter. He's not with us anymore. And I shouldn't have told him the story because we were competitors. We were also friends. But I told him the story. And he looked at me and he goes, well, did you write down what he said? You're obviously going to report it. And the lesson that I learned is everything's on the record unless a politician says it's not. And ever since then, I kept a notebook by my bed, and I realized this isn't about me. It's about the politician. And, you know, the next time something like that happened, I reported what he said. And when he did that with Jeff, I reported what he said. And that was a lesson that I learned. So I remember once Bill Clinton got really upset with me. And I actually don't remember what it was. And started yelling at me at some event and started, like, really yelling. And I was just like, I just didn't get fazed by it because I was so used to it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I learned that at an early age, too.
When
I was a City Hall bureau chief in Chicago, and Jane Byrne was mayor, and she was very volatile and really angry because I was writing stories all the time about her serially sort of abrogating her reform campaign promises. But it got very – it accelerated over time, and she would say things. And, you know, I always was very – you know, I reported the things that she said because it actually went to her state of mind about about things. But getting back to Cuomo, you know, you said an interesting thing that I've always sort of wondered about. And I got to know him a little later in his life. But, you know, he passed in 88 on the presidential race when he was incredibly hot after the 84 convention speech. Just to put it in context for younger listeners, the speech that Mario Cuomo made at the 1984 Democratic Convention had the same sort of galvanizing impact that the speech Barack Obama made in Boston in 2004 and immediately propelled him into the national scene. But every time he had, well, it was really 88 and 92, he towed up to line and then didn't run. And then Bill Clinton offered him a seat on the Supreme Court. He was a very, you know, imagine the literature he would have produced on the Supreme Court. He's a former law professor, yep. and he didn't take that spot either. And you said you wondered whether he felt like he was up to it. Like, you know, there's this thing called imposter syndrome that various, many successful people feel, that I don't want to be found out. You know, maybe I'm not as good as people think. You feel like that was something that kind of haunted him?
I do. It was like, I'm not worthy of this. I'm not good enough to do. You know, people would speculate he doesn't want to be away from home. Or there was speculation, which I think was ridiculous, that he had some kind of crime, mob stuff, which I just think was, you know, slander. But I just think at the end of the day, he just thought he wasn't good enough. And he was sort of gnawed by this sort of insecurity feeling.
I mean,
right?
Part of his strength was he came from this immigrant family.
Right.
He really was this star who rose, you know, from this very hardscrabble immigrant family. And, you know, you could, you know, educated at St. John's, not Harvard.
Yeah, yeah. And she never let you, and he couldn't get jobs at white shoe law firms because they weren't hiring Italian Americans.
Right.
And so his attitude was like, it was justified, right? He had to deal with a lot of bad stuff.
Yeah. And yet one of the towering political figures of our time. What about Andrew? What'd you learn about him, and what do you see in him today?
I never, you know, Andrew's a very talented, kind of logistical guy. And I never was quite as impressed with him as I was with his father. I mean, without taking anything away from him, I'm sure he's a fine governor. But I remember having one pretty intense exchange with him, and he also would call up to yell about stories. And I said to him, Andrew, you know what? You have all the bad qualities of your father and none of the good ones, which was a little mean and overstated, but
yeah.
I mean,
how do you take
really
it?
True. But, I mean, do you think he's as good a governor or as good a speaker as his father was? Or?
No, but I think one of the most interesting – a book you should write when you finish your book, which we're going to speak about, mm-hmm. your book about the New York Times, is Fathers and Sons in Politics. I've made a study of this, you know, and it's really, really interesting to see. And what I find is that the sons are always both embracing and competing with their fathers, because it's impossible at the end of the day to win that. You're always being compared, and
right.
that's a no. So then you try and create your own legacy, and oftentimes it's the opposite. You know, I expect if Andrew Cuomo does run for president in 2020, part of it'll be that he'll be doing something his father.
That's what I think too. Right?
Never
yeah.
did.
Yeah,
you know, but
you see it here in California too with Jerry Brown, right? And
yes.
his father.
Oh yeah,
Brown,
and I was in Chicago with Daly,
yeah.
Rich Daly,
Michelle,
and Adlai Stevenson III. You know,
yeah.
who was in certain ways as austere a politician as his father was known for his, his speaking and his inspiration and so on. Adlai the Third wasn't that kind of, but he was very steeped in policy and so on. It's really an interesting thing. So you're working your way toward your ambition.
Right.
You're at the news, and then you took a turn at USA Today.
Right. So USA Today hired me. There's an editor that I knew from back at my job at the Gannett papers. He was going on to run USA Today. Tom McNamara was his name. And he called me up and he said, do you want to be the political reporter here? He goes, I know you want to work at the New York Times. You told me that back in 1977. It's really true. And then he goes, if you come to USA Today, Johnny Apple will read your stories.
So Johnny Apple, the great
legendary New York Times political reporter.
Right.
Because back in those days, right, there wasn't a web. And the only newspapers you could read when you're in Iowa or New Hampshire was USA Today, because it was everywhere, and the Wall Street Journal. You couldn't even get the Times. So that was his advice. So I was like, and he said, I'll let you write longer, not as long as I would like. None of those 79-inch zoning stories.
Yes.
So I decided to do that. That was where I covered Clinton.
Yeah. And what was that experience like? Because Bill Clinton, we all remember, was, you know, there were Cuomo passed on the election, and Dick Gephardt, who was highly touted after 2008, having run,
right.
passed on that election. Bill Bradley was mentioned, and everybody passed, or not everybody, but many candidates passed on that election. But Bill Clinton, and they passed because George H.W. Bush
seemed
looked
so
unbeatable.
Popular, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
After the war, after winning the war, after winning
the Gulf War, yeah. So what were your impressions of Bill Clinton when you first encountered him?
I always, I'm talking about my earliest impressions, I always thought he was a terrific politician. I thought, you know, he could really get in there and, you know, sort of frame an argument and capture a room and an incredible energy. He'd run everyone else down. Like, he'd start, he wouldn't start too early in the morning, as you know, but he would go till 11 o'clock at night, and he just really enjoyed it and made a point of showing how much he really enjoyed it. And I think that, you know, you can tell when a politician knows that he's on a roll, and you can tell when he knows when he's got an audience. And he just did. And I remember covering him on those bus trips. You know the bus trips he did after the convention?
Yes.
And we'd roll into town, these small towns in Illinois, along the Mississippi, and they'd be packed. Just the streets would be lined with people waiting to see him and Al Gore, because they were traveling together. And he would just keep talking, as he would say, until the last dog died. And it was just and, you know, back in those days, there weren't quite as many people covering as there are now. And the other really big difference was staff traveled with the candidates, because cell coverage wasn't so good. So you just felt like you had this front page, you know, this front row view of history going on that became more and more exciting as you realized, because I think it became clear relatively early on, or at least it did to me, that Clinton was going to win. And it was just like the coolest, most exciting thing ever.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Adam Negurney. What I recall about the early part of that Clinton campaign was the miraculous escape act that he pulled, because he ran into some real turbulence heading into the New Hampshire
draft
primary.
The draft. Jennifer Flowers, I think.
Charges of extramarital relationships,
right.
Jennifer Flowers.
Right.
And also that he had avoided the draft and plainly put it on politics, I guess, at the time.
Right.
Wrote a heartfelt letter to his draft
commander saying, thank you for saving me.
Yeah.
You know, that's why, you know, if other people had gone in the race, people who passed the race had gone in, he might have won. You know, he might not have, someone else might have pulled that ahead of him. You know?
Yeah, but you were must have been up there in New Hampshire when he was, and that was a do or die kind of situation. He had to prove in the New Hampshire primary that he could survive what most, you know, so it's fair to say the conventional wisdom is almost always wrong, but the conventional wisdom was Clinton was dead, that he couldn't survive that. It was really sort of his preternatural campaign skills that saved him.
Right. And people, voters love that, obviously, right? And he got that. People, voters like to see people fight, and he never gave up. I mean, that speech he gave about, I'm going to be fighting for you until the last dog dies.
Yeah, he made his own struggle a metaphor for their struggles.
Exactly right. And people really responded to it. And then the other thing he did that was kind of crafty was, people forget this, he came in second, or you won't forget this, but he came in second place in New Hampshire to Paul Tsongas,
and
right?
Claimed to win.
He claimed to win, the comeback kid. So everyone thinks he won New Hampshire. Well, he didn't, but he's, by all, he did.
Yeah. So this, the USA Today gig led to, finally got you in the door at the Times. You didn't have to call Adam Clymer. And
I've been writing letters, and there's some place in my box, a letter from some editor saying, well, thank you for this, but there will never be a job here for you at the New York Times. And that was a real bug.
Really?
Yeah, I don't actually remember who wrote it. I have some theories. I don't remember. And it was really so depressing. But
you should at least acknowledge that person in your acknowledgments when you finish this book about the New York Times.
Right.
But, okay,
just say one thing though. Yeah. This goes back to the Johnny Apple thing. So everything ties together here. So when Jeff Schmaltz died, right, I was one of the people giving a eulogy for him. And Johnny Apple comes up to me afterwards. It was at Chanterelle, a fancy restaurant in New York. It was just Times people, and Times and Friends. And he comes up to me and he goes, we have an opening for a position in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, and you should be on the list of people like applying for it. I'm like, sure. So I went down to Washington next week, or wherever I was. I was in Washington, and he took me to lunch. These are the old days, right? He took me to lunch at some fancy Italian place called Galileo, I believe. And I think we had a bottle of wine and after dinner drinks. And then he went back to the Bureau in his car. He had someone driving him from place to place. But that was what eventually led to me getting a job.
And what were your first assignments there?
So I was
hired. Were you like a general assignment reporter in the Washington Bureau?
Yeah, I was hired to do politics by the Metro Bureau, Mike Oreskes, and the Washington Bureau, which was Andy Rosenthal and Johnny. So in my first year, I covered national politics with the understanding that I would go back to New York to become the Metro political reporter. Uh-huh. And my first year, I spent covering Bob Dole, which, you know, I know people who don't cover politics might think, oh, wow, that's really boring. No, it was great. I mean, he did lose, and he was going to lose, but he was such a wonderful, great American character. And it was just great to cover. And
you know, I've been thinking a lot about this because, and people have heard me say this here before, my formative experiences in politics were about the same age where John F. Kennedy, you know, I was mm-hmm. like 5-year-old when he came to Stuyvesant Town, where I grew up in New York.
Yeah.
And you know, I went back and read the speech that he gave, and the speech was very much about sacrifice. It was very much about what our responsibilities were as Americans, and it was the kind of speech that you couldn't give today. But this was at a housing development that was built for returning war veterans, and you realize it had just 15 years since the war ended, and there was this sense that, you know, that we kind of have to pull together against these challenges and grab these opportunities. And, you know, so it's ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. That's a line you wouldn't necessarily hear in a political speech today. But the reason I raise it is there was something about that generation of Americans, and Bob right. Dole kind of exemplified that.
Right. Vietnam, World War II veteran, war injury. No, he did, right? And I think that generation is kind of gone. It is gone, right? That sort of.
Yeah. And I wonder if that's one of the reasons why the comedy in our politics is gone. I mean, there are a lot of reasons for it. But, you know, that World War generation, two generation, they all kind of contributed, and many of them fought in the same foxholes together and came from different places, but came together around this big, worthy cause. There was this sense of national destiny and, you know, and values and mission. And so, you know, you wonder whether that – now, maybe that can be recovered with some of these – you see a bunch of these Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans coming into politics now, but – that wasn't as universal an experience as the World War II experience.
And those wars were, you know, I mean, the World War II, like, we were really trying to save the country and save the country from Nazis. And you don't have that same kind of unity about, or even understanding about the Iraq and Afghanistan.
Steve Schmidt, who you know, mm-hmm. who worked for John McCain, loves to tell the story about Bob Dole at Dan Inouye's funeral. Dan Inouye being a Democratic senator mm-hmm. from Hawaii, who also lost an arm in the war, and he and Dole rehabbed together, and they were from different parties, disagreed, but Dole, when he went to the funeral, he was in a wheelchair, and he had them stop, and he walked to the casket, and he paid his respects, and he said, Danny wouldn't have wanted to see me in a wheelchair. But it's a great story because it speaks to something larger than red states, blue states, the kind of, you know, kind of politics that we are so used to today. And, you know, Dole, I think he could be as partisan and as right, caustic right. as anyone, but there was also a level at which, you know, he saw this as service.
I guess McCain's kind of like that too, right? I mean, like, he could be as caustic and partisan and even cynical, but he does have that sort of level of, I look at politics as service, I believe it in, and do I think that is kind of absent now? Yeah, I do, actually. Yeah, it's a shame.
Yeah. So you went up to New York.
Right.
How is that adjustment, covering the politics of New York?
Covering New York politics is really one of the best jobs.
I think that's
world.
When you and I met.
I think so, because you were working for, can I say this on the show?
You can say it. Yeah.
Fernando Ferrer.
You're harder on him than I am.
He lost, didn't he?
He did, yeah. But I remember Adam Nagurny. I remember sitting the first time I met you and you saying that you were calling him 28% Freddy or something. We came pretty close to winning that race.
Yeah.
And had that the race not happened on September 11th.
You think you would have won that?
I think he would have won outright that day.
Okay.
That's what all our data suggested.
Okay.
So
You know what they say about pretty clothes, right?
Well, you know, you heard what I said about conventional wisdom, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what did you learn covering New York politics?
What I learned covering New York politics, there's few things as brutal to cover as New York politics. Jerusalem is probably one.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about wars, but yeah.
But the politics.
Just get pounded all the time, you know, by readers, by politicians, and, you know, I remember one of the candidates, I can't remember, I'm sorry for not whether it was your race or not, Ruth Messenger was running for mayor.
I think she was the race before that.
That's an age thing. I learned a lot, and so I was going on a local TV, New York One, and I would go on these shows and start pontificating, and, you know, and the New York Times paid you to do it, so, right? And but I didn't really know how to do TV. I think of this lesson all the time when I watch colleagues on TV, reporters, not you, but colleagues on TV, and when I'm at my desk one night and the phone rings and it's Ruth Messenger, right? And she goes, can I talk to you about something off the record? I'm like, not for a story. So I said, okay. She said, you know, I really think that what you're saying about me evinces a bias and it's really not fair. And she starts reading me because she got transcripts of the stuff that she said from what I said on New York One. I listened to it. And I thought, whoa, she's right. I definitely crossed the line. So I really learned, like, you really got to learn about what you say and how important it is to be fair. And to, you can offer a point of view but not an opinion when you're a reporter. That's what I learned.
And let me save the discussion about the Times there. You say you can offer you can offer analysis, but not an opinion.
Yeah.
What do you think about where we are today? Because a lot of your colleagues tweet all the time. I think you're on Twitter as well.
I'm on Twitter, yeah.
And so there's a really an open mic night on social media, and a temptation to, and there's plenty to comment on now.
Right.
Are you ever at all uncomfortable with what you read? And do you find yourself saying, you know what, maybe I better not hit send on that one? Something the president ought to practice more often, but that's another story.
I do invoke what I would now call the Ruth Messenger rule, which is I start thinking about, like, is this something that I want to be saying on Twitter? Is this something I'd say on Twitter? Does it cross the line between offering hopefully an interesting point of view and offering an opinion? And do I think, I'm not going to name names, but do I think that reporters at various organizations sometimes go too far? Yeah, I do. I do. Do I think that that is hurtful? Sometimes it is, because I think the public is having real questions about the veracity of newspaper media. I'm using newspapers as a shorthand, and the president is trying to feed that, because I think it's in his interest to do that. So I think it's not helpful when reporters cross the line. Now, do I think they do that? And it's not that often. Most reporters are totally fine. Like, for Maggie Heyman's great, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, she's a great.
She's great.
Reporter.
She's really got that. She's got it down. Do I think people do it deliberately? No, but I think in this culture, as you said, people are trying to be fast. They're trying to be first. They're trying to get clicks, and sometimes they don't think about going.
And sometimes the way to get clicks is to be a little more acerbic than you should.
Outrageous.
To lean
this
in
works,
a little
right?
more when than you you know. I have to say, I wonder sometimes if I were running a news organization, if I would say to my reporters, not my columnists, but my reporters, you know, you can tweet on facts that you're reporting. Do not tweet opinions.
I think the Times, Dean Baquet, the executive editor, has tried to do that with some success, I think. I mean, they're really trying to, I don't use the word police because that's not a good word, but they're really trying to make sure that reporters do tweets that are sort of honest and helpful and don't quite cross that line. This is a difficult period. We're all going through this sort of like learning period, and it's a difficult period.
Yeah. Well, I want to get to that period in a second. You were named the National Political Writer in what, 2002?
2002, yeah.
Yeah. And so you covered two.
I guess
you covered three campaigns, right? You came out here into California after the 2012 campaign. Is that right?
I came out. Well, as chief political reporter, I covered two presidential campaigns. I went there in 2004
and 2008.
Right. So John Kerry versus Bush, which is fine, you know, and then Obama versus McCain, right? And that was a great race for all the obvious reasons that you know. It's a really historic race. And I remember writing this story the night that Barack Obama won and saw the I mean, this will sound like an ego thing, so forgive me, but the big front page headline saying Obama, my name is on it.
Yeah, no, listen, as an old reporter, I wrote the story when Harold Washington got elected the first African-American mayor of Chicago.
It's a huge deal, right?
And I, treasure that headline, you know, that story with my byline on
it's
it.
It's in my, you'll see a copy of it in my office, and there's two copies in my house. You know, I mean, the original plate, so. But at the end of it, like, I remember really going home that night and thinking, well, how is it going to get better than this, right? It's like, what campaign am I going to cover that's better? And I'm not making a judgment about the outcome. I want to be really clear, but I'm making a judgment about covering something that was so historic, right? Like the first African-American. And I spent, you know, I remember thinking weeks in advance about what the lead should be and talking to Jill Abramson, who was the executive editor at the time, as we kind of hashed through every single word at the top of the story. Like, you don't get that many opportunities in this business to write a story like that.
Yeah. You know? No, I identify with that because when I was done with the Obama campaigns, I had to ask myself, is there anything I could do that would rival this? And you set yourself up for disappointment.
For hanging around too long. I mean, we have friends who like did another campaign and maybe shouldn't have.
Right.
Know? It's like,
no, you got to know.
You got to know. Yeah.
But so you decided to come out here.
So what happened is, without making the story too long and boring, anyway, it's not that boring. So in 2000 – it's in 2000 when I was finishing up as a New York political reporter. This job opened up, the Los Angeles bureau chief opened up. I never even thought about that. And an editor from the desk, the national desk, Jim Roberts was his name, came over and said, would you have any interest in being the Los Angeles bureau chief? And I was like, you know, Johnny Appel always said to me, just don't do only politics. Take advantage of the breadth of the New York Times. He said, go to London or do something like that. So I said, let me think about it. And I flew out here. And I spent a couple of days here, and Todd Purdom, who I think you know, was the LA bureau chief at the time. And I said, yeah, I want to do this. I want to try something different. So I went back. I said, yeah. I came out here. I started looking for a house. Todd Purdom had an elaborate party for me at his house that the Times paid for that probably cost at least $5,000. And everything was going on. Then I came back, and September 11th happened. And I remember walking around the streets of New York one night and thinking, you know, I love New York. It's in my blood. I know all the politicians. I know the story so well. And I'm thinking, does it make any sense, right? So Howell Raines was the executive editor at the time. And I walked into his office and I said, listen, I'm honored to be the Los Angeles bureau chief of the New York Times. But I'm wondering whether it makes sense for me to be coming to Los Angeles in the midst of this, one of the hugest stories of the century, right? And he goes, I was thinking the same thing. And within a day, he had pulled it back. So I stuck around, and it was about a year later, the political job opened up, so that was good, which is a long way. So fast forward to 2010, Richard Leland Burke, Rick Burke, who you know, was a national editor at the time. And he said, I remember that you almost went to Los Angeles back in 2001. Do you still want to do that? And I went through the same thought, and I thought, you know what? Do I want to spend my whole life just doing politics and nothing else? Do I want to take advantage of something else? Do I want to get out of my comfort zone? And I said, yeah, I do. I want to do it. And that's what made me decide to do it.
And do you miss – I know you get into the campaigns from time to time.
From time to time. Do I miss – I definitely – so here's the thing. I always want to do politics, right? I love politics. And I really love what I'm doing out here. It's great. But do I miss politics? Yeah, I love it as much as ever. On the other hand, it's the job isn't what it once was, right? Like if I was still it's better to go out on your own than to like get the old shove, right? That, for all I know, that could have happened a month later, right? So I miss it, but I also know that if I went back, it'd be different, right? There's a lot more people writing about it. Like when I was there, like I was sort of like I was probably the last of the ones who were like the single voice of politics in the New York Times.
That was the most prestigious
job, right?
Job in political reporting.
And that's kind of I'm not sure it's a bad thing that it's passed, but there's more. We have a bigger diversity of voices and more, which is probably fine. There's a lot more platforms, a lot more time. But it's not just, you know, Jonathan Martin is fantastic.
He's a great
reporter.
Job there.
He's fantastic. But there's other people writing as well. You know, it's like.
Yeah. I mean, but what you had and what you have is perspective that comes from years and years and years of experience. What did you think when you were watching the 2016 race unfold? Because it's one thing when you're in the middle of it,
right?
But you were drawn in from time to time, but you were kind of watching it from the outside. Did you see it coming?
No, I didn't. But I'm going to make the one caveat which you probably heard me say before, which is, you know, I didn't see Trump winning, but I saw Hillary Clinton win, which she did. I know this sounds like Hillary Clinton, but she won the popular vote. I mean, I think the big the big problem with the way that campaign came out was that everyone was focusing so much on the popular vote. Everyone was focusing so much on the predictive models, Upshot and 538. Those are five. I'm putting them down. And I get the statistical thing, but everyone looked at it and said, oh, Hillary Clinton has a 68% chance of winning. Hillary Clinton has a 98% chance of winning. So everyone who watched us and read us thought she was going to win, quite logically. And I think it also influenced the way reporters wrote about the race.
Yeah, so. which is something new. I mean, that wasn't around when you were doing the races that you did. And nor was it around when I was writing about politics so much when I was doing the races that I was doing. And it struck me, you know, I think of David Broder. He and his wife Anne bequeathed money to the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, where they both went. And we had an event honoring David, who was, you know, an institution at the Washington Post, a counterpart of you and many others at the Times, because he was there for so long. And he was at the Times at one point.
He was, yeah.
And he was famous for jumping in a car and driving around America, knocking on doors and interviewing people. And it seems like if more of that had gone on in 2016, perhaps there would have been a counterweight, and that maybe both reporters and politicians got too reliant on analytics and too reliant on polling.
I think so. And it's a feedback loop. So reporters are looking at these things and thinking that, and they're talking to experts who are saying the same thing, and it becomes a feedback loop. But I think if you get out, maybe if people – I'm not criticizing anyone. I mean, if they did really well, but
– It also has to do with budgets.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, I think news organizations, one of the changing elements of the news business is the economics of news are difficult now. So
that's a factor. But I do think, you know, you and I both, but there's been times when I've been out in Iowa or the field and seen something before polling starts to pick it up. It just happens.
No, so. I mean, listen, I completely believe that.
Yeah.
I think it's a huge problem, and one I hope gets remedied as we move forward, because a lot was missed in 2016. We'll be right back with Adam Negrini. You know, you referenced earlier some of the contemporary challenges that Trump has posed. There is this fake news thing now.
Right.
President likes to, and the New York Times has been very much in his crosshairs, as has CNN, as has the Post, when stories are written that he doesn't like or that are he views as unflattering or unhelpful, he dismisses them as fake news. And a fair number of his supporters embrace that. And now we're in this world where there's a competition over facts. How much more difficult does that make reporting and covering government and politics?
Well, I think it makes it a lot more difficult because you know in the old days you would write a story, you do everything you would do to make sure it was right, and now you assume that readers would read you and assume that you were right, and now you don't, right? Like, so for example, before I came in here, I saw the Washington Post had just posted another story about Moore, and there's some more evidence of him having some kind of relationships with, I think, a 14-year-old girl. And I thought, a lot of people are going to read that and think, well, I don't believe that because it's in the Washington Post. And that's a new thing. I don't think that's good for
democracy.
That was the
original response of Roy Moore.
Right? It was, right? And that, you know, that's what the president's been pushing. And, you know, that's the whole thing about fake news. And I mean, this is the old Moynihan. It's almost a cliche now. You're entitled to your own facts, but not your own opinions, but not your own facts. I think it's really, 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 really bad for society that we don't have this basic assembly of facts to work off of. We can disagree about stuff, but like people should be able to agree on what is true, right? You can disagree about, you know, whether or not, I mean, Moore is probably not the best example to use, but whether or not he had improper relations. But let's just start from there and then figure out whether it's okay.
Well, what about the basic facts even about this this Russia story, where the entire intelligence community agrees that something happened and the president calls it a hoax?
Right. That's a much better example.
You know, I mean, the foundation of democracy is a free press to keep government accountable.
Right.
So if you lose that, that's a frightening prospect. Is it recoverable? Can we get back to a place where there's a basic agreement on fundamental facts, or are we in to a new world that is going to continue to be exacerbated by social media and the way we can silo ourselves and choose the news outlets that affirm our points of view?
I'm not sure if we were having this conversation 10 years ago that I would know where we would have reached this place today. So I'm reluctant to say that we can't get back to where we were, but I'm not confident. I mean, I just think the media is so siloed, the 24/7 and the competition and the individual people. And, you know, I just think that individual voices out there and the partisan news, deliberately partisan news and the making up of stuff and the fake news, I'm not sure. But I think that it makes it more and more important for mainstream newspapers, and I use that in an old school kind of way, like the Times, like the Post, to like do everything they can to make sure their coverage is as straight and correct and helpful as possible. That's why the ABC mistake was so damaging. I mean, you have to be – we all make mistakes, right? We do, but we have to be more careful than ever, because I just think it's really important that at least some citizens believe the newspapers, the media, as a sort of source of what is right and what is wrong. We can move from there about what you believe on, who you support, but just on what the basic facts are.
Their credit, ABC moved quickly to discipline the reporter and to acknowledge the mistake.
Yep.
But it certainly lent credence to the argument that Trump was trying to make and gave him an escape valve.
Or a distract valve.
How's this all impacting on the Times?
I think the Times is struggling with this every day. I mean, I think we're doing really well, but I mean, I think we have to be, you know, we're getting pounded all the time by the president. We're being really assertive in our reporting. The whole dispute about whether or not to use the word lie in describing what the president said. But I'm going to sound like a booster, but I think the paper's done really well, acquitted itself really well during a really difficult time. And it's been great for business. You know?
Has it been?
No, it's been great for subscription. I mean, I was talking to somebody at the paper, and he was saying, you know, we do not and should not look at it this way. But the fact of the matter is.
Because part of the goal of the president clearly is to try and hurt the Times economically and the other institutions that are covering him that he's unhappy with, CNN, The Post, NBC News. He's gone after all of them, and he's gone after them in ways that seem designed to try and hurt them from a business standpoint.
Right. And it's had the opposite effect so far. And whether that will, you know, digital subscriptions to the New York Times are up, and they're clearly up, the Trump up, right? They're up for that reason. Now, whether that will continue after the president, you know, after we moved on from this president to something else, I don't know. But I.
Now, the legendary Gay Talese wrote a book in the 60s called The Kingdom and the Power, which was a history of the New York Times. Just a riveting book. You are now embarked on the next – it's been 50 years since that book came out. You're embarked on the next chapters of that story. Why did you decide to undertake that?
I grew up on that. I loved that book when I read it. I just loved it. I always loved reading about the Times, and I always just thought there was a really great – I mean, there's been a lot of books done about the Times since, but nothing in the spirit of Gay Talese. And it's something I just thought about for a long time, and I kept putting it off. And basically, I'm working at the paper, which makes it complicated, and it's hard when you're at a newspaper to do a job like that. And also, you know, for anyone who's read Gay Talese, who wants to even try to be right?
One of the really, truly great writers of our
Our century, right? Yeah. Just an unbelievable, you know. And then finally, I kept thinking about it. I talked to my agent about it, and she said, let's do it. So I, I thought about a lot of other books, David, but this was a real work of passion for me. It's like something I really, really, really wanted to do. And I just thought there was a need to do it. And I'll tell you something, after I just got the contract to do it, right, I went and I met with Gay Talese. And I don't think I ever met him before. I was really nervous, not as nervous as I was when I met Adam Clymer. I went to his house and I knocked on the door, and he opened it up and he goes, I've been waiting for 15 years or someone to write this book. Come on in. And he's been like, whatever I can do to help you.
Been helpful, huh?
He's just been such a class act. He's been anything I want.
So how do you as a Timesman, as they were called, now it's Timesmen and women. But how do you approach it? Seeing as how you're still the Los Angeles bureau chief for the New York Times.
So the span of this book starts in 1977, kind of random. Gay's book ended in 68, but this 77 was the year that Abrams and Law became executive editor. And it goes through the end of Jill Abramson's tenure, which is about 2012, 2014. And the idea is that after I'm done with the main narrative, I'll come back and write a long epilogue. So for the most part, not completely, for the most part, I'm writing about people who are gone or I don't have to deal with so much, which makes it easier. I don't want to be in a situation – I don't shouldn't be in a situation where I'm writing about somebody who I'm dealing with. So that's made it more sort of handleable. And like, so I'm writing – most of my reporting and energies have been about, you know, so far, Rosenthal and Frankel and Keller and Howell Raines and Jill Abramson. At some point, I'll move on to Dean Baquet. But my hope is that by the time I begin focusing on that, you know, Dean will have moved on.
Yeah. Dean being the current executive editor of the – you just named the distinguished journalists who have been editors of the Times. Times has had a lot of enormous impact and success over the years. Also some moments of trial where reporters have been less than what you'd hope, plagiarizing and misreporting and so on. How much of that are you going to deal with in your book?
So there's been a couple of classic examples. Obviously, Jason Blair being one. Some of the reporting.
Explain the Jason Blair.
I'm sorry.
Story.
Yeah, I'm shorthanding here.
That's okay.
So Jason Blair was a plagiarizer. He worked for the paper 2001, and it turned out that he was just making up stuff. He wasn't even going out. He had wrote – the Times wrote a 7,000-word front-page story where they went back and they re-reported everything he did and just laid out everything that he did wrong. It was a devastating moment for the paper. I mean, it was – on one hand, it was really, really kind of –
He wrote compelling narratives that just weren't true.
It really helps when you're writing a story when you make stuff up, you know?
Yes, they're called novels and short stories.
Exactly, yeah, right? You know, there's some people who said that Jason Blair did more damage to the paper than anyone else, and I think it really created a whole new chapter in journalism and in the New York Times. Much more fact-checking, much more concern about not getting stuff wrong, much more skepticism. You know, that's a big part of this story, as is, you know, Judith Miller. And she was a reporter who wrote about Iraq with some disputed stories about it.
But she became, in certain ways, a vehicle of for the government narrative that turned out not to be true.
Right. And she ended up leaving in part because of that. Yeah. So that'll clearly be part of the story. I mean, the thing that's so great about the paper is that they're brilliant people, reporters and editors, and they're also really flawed people who, for the most part, were trying to do some really good things, but sometimes didn't.
And how are you doing the reporting on this? Going out and interviewing? And
there's two main things I'm doing. One is interviewing anyone I can find who's still alive. I've done extensive interviews with executive editors, other editors, people who are involved with the paper. But the other thing is archives. Archives are, you know, they end at a certain point, which I'll tell you about if you're interested. But archives are fantastic. You go back and you can read sort of the memos that people wrote and the notes to each other and the, you know, planning reports and personal letters. And those two things are the main elements of it. And a lot of that stuff's really fresh.
You know, you talk about the renewed commitment to fact-checking and rigor. But, you know, we read that the Times has had to cut layers of editors from the desk, and which suggests that even though there's a boost in subscriptions and so on, there's still financial pressures there. The Post has the benefit of having the richest man in the world as their publisher,
right,
which is helpful. How concerned are you about the cuts that are being made in terms of preventing or not being preventing the kinds of mistakes that, you know, you've spoken about?
So I understand the strategy behind the cuts. What they're basically doing is cutting layers of editing, right? So they can hire more reporters in the Washington, more investigative reporters, more, I'm going to use this word really advisedly, content producers. I mean, because it also includes people who know how to package stuff digitally.
You have to do now, which we didn't have to do.
Which we didn't have to do. And, I think the Times and the Post does some really brilliant digital stuff. So I get it. Unlike the Post, we can't afford both. So I get the decision. Do I also get the price, the potential price of the decision? Yeah. Do I think it's possible there's going to be more mistakes and stories? You know, editing is a great thing. I can't believe I'm saying this. I'm sure you had the same where editors made you want to put a bullet in your head. But I think editing is a great thing. And I miss having that level of editing. But
listen, I was a young man when I was a reporter at the Tribune, and I grew up there, and the environment was so good because there was really experienced people, both reporters and editors, who were there to help and teach me the craft.
Right.
And who were there to say, you know what, you don't have this story yet. And that's an important function. Or to say, you know, this doesn't strike me as right. Are you sure about this?
Right.
And to force you to go back and check your facts. Before we go, this is not your first book. You wrote another book called Out for Good, The Struggle to Build a Gay Rights Movement in America. You wrote it with Dudley Clendenin in the late 90s. And you are gay.
Yeah.
The scope of your career, the span of your career has seen this incredible shift in this country. Are you surprised at how quickly these things have changed in the last few years, in the last decade, given the history that you've written about before?
Yeah, I don't think there's any other social movement, civil rights movement, if you want to call it that, which I think we should, where there's been as much change as fast. There's certainly not – that was the case in the African-American community. It's just – it's been startlingly fast. And even with some of the backlash that you're seeing today, it's just – it's kind of shocking. And you see it in the New York Times newsroom. I remember when I was like, you know, that 20-year-old kid thinking – how could there ever be gay people working in the New York Times? And in fact, one of the things I write about was that there was a lot of homophobia on the part of the.
Did you feel inhibited about revealing who you were?
By the time I got there, it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. By the time, it was like almost an asset by the time I got there. But like, I have friends who were there back in the 70s and 80s, and that was a really, really difficult thing. The world has changed in a really, really dramatic way on that front. It's just really something.
You know, we had as a guest on this program Fred Hochberg, who you know. And Fred talked about his experiences as a young man and how painful they were in both his personal relationship, professionally, and so on. And it struck me that there were probably young people listening who couldn't conceive of that,
right,
you know, because
right.
times have changed so dramatically and for the better.
Right.
So, and when is this New York Times tome due?
It's due to the publisher the summer after next, which I'm hopeful to make.
Well, Adam,
you're listening, I'm going to make that.
Yeah. Yes. Adam, you know this, so I'm not, this is not for purely for benefit of our audience, but you truly are one of the great political reporters that of our time. And I as much as I so admire some of the others who are out there covering this last campaign, you know, I emailed you from time to time and said, man, I wish you were out there. So I still enjoy reading your stuff. You're still dabbling in politics out here.
I love it. You saying that makes me feel even better about it.
But I hope that you keep a hand in, because your perspective is really, really important.
I appreciate that.
Adam Nagurny, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.